Hello, I'm Father Ambrose Little, the director of the Thomistic Institute. Before we begin the next great TI lecture, a quick word with you. Thanks to donors like you, our content is cutting through the digital noise with the truth of the Catholic intellectual tradition. But we can't keep it coming without your help. If you enjoy programs like the TI Podcast and Aquinas 101, please consider a small contribution of $25 or more. You can use the link in the description or visit our website to donate. Your generosity ensures that these important programs will continue to lead souls to the truth all over the world. So please enjoy this episode, and may God bless you and keep you in His grace.
Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
Let me start by saying a little bit about the title of the talk, which is Rights, Liberties, and the Nature of Medicine, to try and motivate what the connection is between these three parts of it, the rights part, the liberty part, and the nature of medicine part. If we were looking at medicine sort of as a phenomenon in the United States right now, we'd see that it's a locus of a number of controversies. Controversies such as controversies over abortion, over euthanasia, over sex, gender, and race. And many of these controversies are articulated in terms of questions of rights. They're also proximate to a number of questions about liberty. So in the context of many of these discussions of abortion or euthanasia or issues of sex, race, and gender, there are questions about the liberty of inquiry and freedom of expression and academic freedom that have often also arisen. Right? So we've got these questions about rights and questions about liberties, and they're closely caught up. And you could see in those a connection also to a similar phenomenon in American universities. Right? There are questions about rights to acknowledgement, to equity, to justice of various sorts, and also questions of liberty, academic liberty, especially liberty of inquiry and freedom of expression. And if we were looking at the university, right, and we were looking at these various clashes, right, clashes between assertions of rights and assertions of liberties, I think one way to address those and think about them would be to ask a question in what I'll call an Aristotelian register, which just means to ask it in the way that Aristotle would have asked it. And that's to say, well, what is the university for? What is its purpose? Right? Which is the Aristotelian way of asking, what is the nature of a university? And so by a parallel process, we might ask the same question about medicine. We have contestation of liberties and rights, and we might think that an adequate way or helpful way to get at those questions is to ask about medicine what its nature is, and to ask that in an Aristotelian register, which is to say, to ask the question, what is medicine for? What is its purpose? Right. Here's another way that you get, I think, to the same sort of methodological starting point, and that's to notice that although we frequently think and talk of rights as if they're very atomistic, right, they're things that are asserted by individuals and avoid, and that they somehow detach or divorce us from relationships with other people, in fact, right, it's the case that all rights are relational. Right? If I have a right to something, then someone else has to stand in a relationship to me of having some sort of obligation in relationship to me. Right? And so every right relationship, right, every relationship in which there's rights, is a right or a relationship in which there is somebody who has a right-related duty to somebody, right, and then somebody who is the beneficiary of that duty. And of course, medicine involves such relationships in which rights are asserted, the doctor-patient relationship most prominently, right? And so one way that we could find out about the nature of those rights, right, the corresponding obligations, the absence of obligations, which we could call liberties, is by asking about that relationship, well, what's its nature? And I think that brings us back to the same question that I mentioned earlier. In order to find out what the nature of the doctor-patient relationship is, we want to ask a question about medicine in an Aristotelian register. What is medicine? What is medicine for? What is its purpose? Okay, so I'm going to give an answer to that question tonight, and I'm going to say a few things about it that I hope is as boring and obvious an answer as it's possible to give, right? Such a boring, right? I can see people are disappointed. Oh, no, it's going to be a boring and obvious talk. I apologize for that, right? This answer should be such that when you hear it, you're like, yeah, that's obviously true. But I promise there will be also a contrasting answer that other people would give so that there's an actual disagreement that's at stake. And I'll also, in the middle maybe of the lecture, if somebody reminds me, I'll tell you my favorite philosophy joke, which is a pretty good joke. And so you can look forward to that, right, just as something if you're worried about the boring and obvious answer that I'm about to give. So the answer that I'm about to give is one that I develop in the book that Kevin mentioned, The Way of Medicine, Ethics in the Healing Profession, which I wrote with a friend of mine who's a physician at Duke University. And we call this answer The Way of Medicine, right? And our account of The Way of Medicine is that medicine is a practice that exists for the sake of human health. And not human health in the abstract and not human health at a population level, but in its paradigmatic case, human health as it exists or could exist or should exist in the patient to whom a physician is in a particular relationship. Right? That's the health for which a patient or for which a physician is concerned. And the physician professes a commitment to that health, to the health of his or her patient with whom he or she stands in a relationship. And here, physician is a kind of stand-in for us for a number of different roles that people can play within the medical profession. Right? So I think one could get a very analogous account of nursing, right, by thinking about the way of medicine. Right? And it would stand in a pretty close relationship to what we're saying about the nature of medicine. Okay. Now, health on this account, I'm going to say now, and I'm going to talk more about this later, right, has two aspects to it. Right? On the one hand, by health, I mean a kind of objective norm for individuals of a particular species, whether it's the human species or the squirrel species. We were talking about squirrels earlier, so maybe we'll go back to squirrels later. On the one hand, it's kind of norm by which we measure individuals in a wide variety of different species. Right? Is this a healthy squirrel or is it not a healthy squirrel, a healthy human being or not a healthy human being? And on the other hand, right, health is a good. And I want to say, and I'll talk more about this at various points, that health has objectivity in both these domains, right? It's an objective norm. There's something that it actually is objectively the case about whether something is healthy or not, and it's objectively good, right? That it's a genuine good for individuals of the human species to pursue in the way that human beings do. And if we think about the way of medicine, as I've just described it, and the nature of health, as I've just described it, then some limits to medical practice start to emerge, right? And those limits have a bearing on what we can talk about in terms of the rights and liberties that are at stake here. So first of all, right, physicians don't really need, right, as a matter of professional obligation, to work outside the domain of health. Right? If a patient comes to a physician with a concern that is not, strictly speaking, a health-related concern, then just as a physician, right, that is not within the domain of the professional commitment that the physician has made. Right? And so I think it will follow from that, and we'll talk more about this as the talk goes on, follows from that that there's an important sense in which this is not a right on the part of patients, right, to expect something from physicians that goes outside the domain of health with which the physician is fundamentally concerned. But an even stronger claim, I think, also follows from this account of the way of medicine, which is that physicians should not act contrary to the good to which they've made their professional commitment, the good of health in the person of their patients, right? To act in a way that deliberately brings about an absence of health or a privation of health, right? Or is contrary to the health of the patients, to deliberately seek to do that, right? It seems to me to run contrary to the professional commitment of a physician, right? And so there we could actually talk about a right and even an absolute right that patients have not to have physicians act in ways that are deliberately contrary to their health. Okay. And then finally, third, right, the third sort of implication of this account of medicine is that whenever a physician is engaging with a patient, that engagement needs to be sort of understood through the primary lens of a concern for the patient's health. There's lots of other things that a physician could be concerned for, right, and lots of other concerns that could shape their relationship with the patient. And the history of medicine has shown many such unfortunate shapings of that concern, right, when the physician's concern for the patient is shaped by discriminatory racial attitudes or sexual attitudes or religious attitudes or a wide variety of other discriminatory attitudes that somebody might take, right? That is a distortion of the professional commitment of medicine. But it's also a distortion of the professional commitment of medicine if that attitude towards the patient is shaped even by sort of very high-flown ideals, right? If your concern for your patient is primarily being refracted through a concern for something like social justice, and that's determining what you think you should do for or with or to your patient, right? Then I think that also is problematic from the standpoint of the way of medicine. Okay, so what's the alternative? I did promise an alternative to this boring and crushingly obvious account of the nature of medicine. Right? In our book, we call the alternative the provider of services model. Okay? And on the provider of services model, what medicine is simply a set of skills, right, that are available on the part of the physician to be able to bring about patient satisfaction and patient well-being, where that well-being is really to be understood in terms of a satisfaction of desires that the patients have. And the ethic that emerges on the provider of services model, right, is very different from the ethic that emerges from the way of medicine. Right? Something is permissible and indeed might even be obligatory, right, on the provider of services model if it is something that's A, legal, right? So you don't move outside the spectre or the spectrum of what's legal, right? If it's possible, you shouldn't do things to patients or for patients, even if they want them, that are impossible or you can't be successful at. And then third, and maybe most importantly, if it's something that the patient has autonomously asked for or demanded. Right? And if all three of those conditions are met, then very frequently, right, people working within the paradigm of the provider of services model are going to think, right, that now what's being asked of the physician is in fact a right on the part of the patient to which the physician has a corresponding duty of providing. Okay. Now, you might say, and this is totally reasonable, well, it's not just subjective satisfaction of preferences, right? Every physician thinks that health is important, and that's true. Every physician does think that health is important, and people who are in some sense paradigm cases of what we're calling the provider of services model nevertheless recognize the importance of health. But I think there's three ways in which the understanding of health that runs within the provider of services model is very different from the way of medicine as I've described it so far. The first is that within the provider of services model, proponents of that model very often work with a more subjective understanding of health, so that health is something like a social construction, right? And that will change our understanding of what's reasonable to, not reasonable to do in relationship to health. But also, physicians are not just permitted but encouraged in many ways to work outside the domain of health. If medicine is a set of skills, it's a set of tools, right, that physicians are well trained in being able to use, right? That set of tools is available to be used for a wide variety of purposes that are not obviously related to the purpose of health, right? They might be used for social purposes, it might be used for aesthetic purposes. The same set of medical tools might be used to both bring life into being, but also to end life. Right? And that actually then brings me to the third way in which the provider of services model is, I think, very different from the way of medicine. Right? It's not just that physicians are encouraged and allowed to work outside the domain of health, right? But they're often encouraged, allowed, and sometimes required to work contrary to the good of health. So it seems to my colleague and I, Farr and I, right, that euthanasia, for instance, right, is directly contrary to the good that is the central concern of medicine. Right? To deliberately end somebody's life is to work in the most direct possible way, right, contrary to the good of health as it could be possibly realized in that person's organic being. Right? It's to end all of their health. And so what on the provider of services model is something that is not just permitted on a number of accounts, but increasingly thought to be required of physicians, right? It's an entitlement, it's a right on the part of the patient, right? The right to have one's life ended deliberately if one has voluntarily and autonomously chosen to have that done, right? On the way of medicine is going to be, in some respects, the most grave violation of the professional commitment that physicians are expected to make. Okay. I'm going to talk a little bit later about the way that autonomy plays into the picture of the provider of services model. But first, I want to say a little bit more about health, about the two dimensions of health that I mentioned earlier. I said that health is an objective norm and also that health is an objective good. Okay. When we talk in our book about health being an objective norm, We take a fairly, again, Aristotelian approach to this, right? What we want to say is that health is something that is manifest and characterized by activity of a whole organism of a particular sort in a particular species, right, at a particular stage in that species' life, right? What do I mean by that, right? Well, on the one hand, we want to say that health is primarily predicated of squirrels or of human beings or of dogs or of cats, right, rather than of parts of any of those animals. Right? So health is something that, in its paradigmatic sense, is something that we say of the organism as a whole. And to the extent that we want to talk about the health of parts or healthy parts, a healthy heart or a healthy hand or a healthy eye, right, that has to be understood in terms of the health of the whole organism. But second, the health of the whole organism is manifested most clearly, it's on display most clearly, and we understand it most clearly when we see that organism in its activity, in its characteristic forms of activity. So squirrels have characteristic forms of very annoying activity, right? They run around chattering at things and hiding their nuts and racing up trees and just being annoying in that special squirrely way, right? Which is why the adjective squirrely is something that we use of annoying things. Like I won't give you any examples of that. It would be impolitic, okay? We look at an organism through time, right, in order to get a sense of what its characteristic activities as that kind of organism are. And those are the indicators, those point us towards an understanding of what the health of that organism is. But it's also the case that we have to be very sensitive to things like, what are the characteristic activities of this organism at this particular age as opposed to that particular age? So the health of an 80-year-old man is very different from the health of a 20-year-old man, or for those of us who are not 80 but still getting old, Professor Tully, right? Our health is different. What it means for us to be healthy is different from what it means for all these folks to be healthy, right? But it still is intelligible. We can still make discriminations between what it would mean for me to be healthy and not healthy and what it would mean for Kevin to be healthy or not healthy. And similarly, there is a certain kind of relativity in health, not just to age and other conditions, but also obviously to sex. Right, so that the health of an 80-year-old woman, right, is different in certain respects from the health of a 20-year-old woman, but the health of a 20-year-old woman is obviously also different in various respects from the health of a 20-year-old man. And so there's a kind of relativity here to health on our account, but we want to say this is not a subjectivity. It's not the case that health is simply whatever the person who is considering whether they're healthy or not thinks it to be or wants it to be. There's an objective norm that applies. Right, but it applies in ways that are relative to what species they're from, what age they're from, what their circumstances are, what their sex is, right, and a variety of other features that go to make health, especially for human beings, very, very complicated. Now, here's a way that we could get to something like what we're calling the provider of services model that would say, yeah, you know what, medicine is just all about health. That we accept that. I accept your claim that medicine is primarily about health. Right? But we could get to the provider of services model through a definition of health that's very different from the one that I've just given, and that would be the definition given by the World Health Organization, right? According to which health is a state of complete mental, social, psychological well-being, right? Maybe even spiritual, mental, social, psychological, spiritual well-being, right? Well, what of your well-being, what of your flourishing as an individual of the human species is not encompassed by that very capacious definition? Probably nothing. Right? I mean, if there's some respect in which you're not flourishing, we can probably characterize that as a respect that is either mental, physical, social, psychological, spiritual, right? And if that's the case, and what the physician is primarily concerned with is health, then what part of your life is the physician concerned with? You're concerned with all of it, right? Potentially everything falls within the remit of the physician's professional commitment. Okay? And that doesn't seem right to us. It seems, in fact, the exact opposite of the claim that we want to make, which is that medicine is, in some very important respects, limited, right? It has limits. It's limited to health, right? Well, this other conception could say that. But what we want to say is that health is only itself one limited aspect of the totality of goods that go to make up human flourishing. It's a real good, right? And now we're on the health is not just an objective norm for individuals of a species, but health is an objective good for individuals of our species. Y'all are better off being healthy than unhealthy, right? And we can make sense of many of your actions in terms of a desire to be healthy, right? That doesn't have to point to some further thing that you're trying to get out of it. If any of you take medicine on some occasion, and I say, why do you want to take medicine? You have to give me some sort of answer, right? You can't just say, well, I want to take medicine for its own sake. That doesn't really make a lot of sense. But if you tell me, I want to take this medicine because I've got an infection and I want to clear it up, and these are antibiotics and they'll work to clear up the infection, and by clearing up the infection, I'm going to be healthier. If I say, well, why do you want to be healthy? You might have a further answer, but I don't think you need a further answer. I think you can say, well, it's just better to be healthy than not healthy. Okay? And that indicates, I think, that's one part of a larger story that would indicate that health is an essential part of human flourishing. It's an essential aspect of what it means for a human being's life to go well. But it's not the only such aspect. How many people here have friends? Come on. Everybody, please, thank you. Okay, good, right? Why do you have friends? Do you have them only for the sake of the other benefits that you can get from having friends? If that's the way in which you have friends and the reason for which you have friends, then what don't you have? You don't have friends, right? If your friends are exclusively for the instrumental value that you get out of them, then you just don't have friends. Friends have to be had for their own sake. They have to be valued for their own sake, and friendship has to be sought for its own sake. Has anybody ever taken a class simply because they wanted to know more about the material that was in that class and not because it was required and their advisor were forcing them to do it? Yeah, I hope so. I hope you have that opportunity from time to time. Maybe even a philosophy class, right, that you wanted to take just because it's a philosophy class. I think that's great, right? I think a well-lived life is constituted around a number of goods that are essential aspects of human flourishing that include life and health, absolutely, but also friendship and knowledge, aesthetic experience, right, the experience of what's beautiful, good work, the ability to play, particular kind of personal integrity that I think is good in itself. And I would also include the good of religion, right, of getting right with whatever greater than human source of meaning and value there is in the world, right? So if we're talking about what it means for medicine to prosper, right, then our account is going to be limited, right? Medicine prospers when it's focused on one good, on the good of health, right? But if we're talking about what it means for human beings to prosper, then things are much more complicated, right? There are many, many more goods at stake. On the subject of philosophy, we're about the midpoint of the talk, right? So I will just tell you that my colleague Farr, with whom I wrote this book, physician at Duke, very nice university, his son David, lovely, lovely young man, was an undergraduate at my university, at the University of South Carolina. He's the only person at my university or in my entire life who has ever called me on a regular basis or at all, Dr. T. I'm not sure how he arrived at that, but it's always, Dr. T. And he said, Dr. T, in class. This was offensive. What's the difference between a pepperoni pizza and a philosophy professor? I'm like, David, tell me what the difference is between pepperoni pizza and a philosophy professor. He said, a pepperoni pizza can feed a family of four. Okay. I haven't forgotten that, and I won't. Okay, so here's what I want to say now. I want to go back to the way of medicine and talk a little bit about a way in which our picture of the way of medicine coheres with a particular kind of approach to medicine that's been taken by others and how I think we add to it in certain respects. So the way of medicine, again, the physician's fundamental commitment is to the good of health and his or her patients, right? And that's the good that the physician's fundamental vocational commitment is oriented to. I think that understanding, right, is internal to the self-conception of many, many physicians, both now and going back through history, right, and especially physicians who have operated within the Hippocratic tradition, right? We could say that what we've done is we've sort of articulated what that self-understanding is within that tradition, how physicians have understood what it is that they do, and how from that self-understanding you can arrive at what we could call an internal ethic of medicine, right? The ethics of medicine that arises from physicians' self-understanding of themselves as engaged in a particular kind of practice aimed at a particular sort of good, okay? What we do in our book, I think is interesting and I think is helpful, is we also then step back, right, and ask, well, what would be our assessment of that internal understanding and that internal ethic of medicine if we stepped back and looked at it from the standpoint of practical reason, right, in its entirety, right? That is, from the standpoint of ethics, unrestricted ethics, right? And the ethics that's available to us from the standpoint of natural reason, and hence the ethics that we could call a natural law ethics. Would that internal ethics of medicine be vindicated, or would it be vitiated? It might be the case that the practice of torture has an internal ethic, right? So torturers, you know, they share a set of commitments to one another. There's the, you know, the torturers community, and they get together at conventions, and there's the American Association of Torturers. And they, you know, they write papers on the internal ethics of torturers, probably like their fundamental norm is leave no question unanswered, right? You just have to keep going until you get the answer. Well, what would happen if we looked at that practice and then stepped back and assessed that practice from the standpoint of ethics in an unrestricted sense, right? Of the natural law ethics, right? That was able to assess the practice, right? From the standpoint of reason as such, of practical reason as such, I think that practice would be vitiated. Would not be vindicated. It would be shown to be a false, right, malicious, malign practice in a way that we don't think is true of medicine. Right? We think that when you step back and engage in that natural law reflection on the practice of medicine, the reflection is vindicatory. Now, that's a long story that I'm not going to like present you with all the details of, but I am going to just sketch out for you three norms that we think that vindicatory effort of natural law reflection on the nature of medicine provides. Three norms that in one way or another intersect with the internal ethics of medicine, reinforce the internal ethic of medicine, and show that internal ethic of medicine to be vindicated. So what are these three norms? Right? The first, which I think is a norm of ethics as such, it's a norm that you can read much more about in Lying in Christian Ethics or in my forthcoming but probably very expensive Killing in Christian Ethics. Wait for your library to get it. The first of these norms is that one should never intentionally damage or destroy any of these fundamental human goods that I've been discussing. Right? To betray a friend deliberately, right? That's wrong. It's also bad, right? But it's wrong. It's not something that one should do. Right? To deliberately lie, I've argued elsewhere, is always wrong. That's, again, a story that we don't need to trot out all the details of. Right? But what binds together a whole set of what I would consider to be moral absolutes, right? Involving relationships, involving your relationship to knowledge, involving your relationship to life and health, involving your relationship to good work. Right? I think it's wrong for you to deliberately do bad work. Right? Not fail to do good work, because you're doing something else, for instance, but to deliberately ruin your work, I think that's I think that's morally wrong, right? What ties all of these things together is that they're intentional instances of damage to a basic good. Okay, so that's a first norm, right? And I think from that norm emerges certain kinds of rights, absolute rights, not to have that done to oneself, and we can see this intersect with the third of the norms that I said, or the second of the norms that I said emerges from the way of medicine. A second norm that we discussed that we think is important in the context of medicine as well, but has an unrestricted importance for all of our lives, is that we shouldn't arbitrarily let our interest in some people, whether it's ourselves or those who are close to us, affect the way in which we allow for the distribution of benefits and burdens with respect to those goods, right? If we arbitrarily privilege the benefits of our pursuit of good in ourselves or the people that we love, right, and allow burdens to fall onto other people without benefits falling onto them for no good reason, right, then I think we've traversed what we could call the norm of fairness. This is clearly at stake in the domain of medicine when I think we could probably just look over the last week or month or year of newspaper articles about medicine and find instances in which people have made well-founded accusations that they've been poorly treated, for instance, on the basis of considerations of race or class or gender or religion. Right? And on our account, all of these are violations of the second norm. And then the third norm that we think is important, that I think is, again, unrestrictedly important. It's important for everybody here. It's important for physicians. You could put something like this. Think vocationally. Right? Think in terms of the way that commitments to the goods that are essential to human flourishing are necessary for human flourishing. You can't just do whatever it is that you feel like because it's attractive at one time or another. In order to achieve genuine excellence and genuine flourishing, you need to make commitments, right? And then you need to put those commitments into order with one another so that they don't conflict. They don't come into conflict with one another, right? And pretty soon you're in the business of thinking about your life as a whole and how the various commitments are prioritized, that you make are prioritized within that life and stand in an ordered relationship with one another, right? Not a inflexible, fixed relationship such that you just run over everything in an attempt to put your life in order, right? But you do attempt to see your life, as it were, from the standpoint of its death in a way that you can recognize how it was ordered in terms of those commitments that you make. This is very important, obviously, if you're a physician, right? If you are a physician, that ordering of commitments revolves in a very important way around your commitment to the health of your patients. And it's a way that has very important consequences, right, for what you need to do when it's 3 a.m. and a patient has called you up to say that something very drastic is bad for has happened to them, or you're on the airplane and the steward comes on and says, is there a doctor on the plane? We need help. And what you're doing is you're watching John Wick 4 and you'd really like to keep watching that. Well, you know, John Wick needs to take back seat. It's a hard lesson, isn't it? Right. I mean, there's nothing like John Wick 4 on an airplane. But when your professional commitments require it, then your vocation, right, means that you have certain obligations that are attendant on it. I think that's important from the standpoint of the doctor thinking about their own life, but it also is very important from the doctor standpoint thinking about, this will be the next thing that I talk about. I'm going to talk about just a couple more things. It's very important for the physician thinking about the standpoint of their patients. Because while the physician's fundamental commitment is to the health of their patients, right, a patient's life extends far beyond just the good of health. And the patient's own vocation very frequently involves commitments that prioritize other goods over goods of health at some particular moment or other. Right? I have a daughter who was prescribed medicine for her morning sickness with the child that she most recently had about a year ago, her first son. Right? She gets very, very bad morning sickness. It's almost incapacitating, and she was given a drug that unfortunately basically knocked her out. It put her to sleep, and she had to go to her physician and say, I can't take this because my 2-year-old twins are destroying my house, and I have to see to that. She had vocational commitments, right, that were not commitments to the good of health. They were commitments to the good of her family, right? But that meant that her commitment to her health needed to be shaped by those other commitments in ways that made a difference for what medicine she would take and what medicine she wouldn't. And I think that's important because it goes to a contrast that I want to draw between two different understandings, right, that on the one hand, we have with the provider of services model, and on the other hand, we have with the way of medicine. Right? The provider of services model is really centered on the notion of autonomy. Right? Autonomy is the most important conceptual part and ethical part of the provider of services model. At the end of the day, what settles moral questions and frequently results in entitlements on the part of patients, rights on the part of patients, is whether the patient has autonomously requested or in some cases demanded that some service that the physician is capable of providing, and that's legal, right, that some physician provide that, right? And increasingly what you see, right, for instance, again, in the domain of abortion or euthanasia, is that when what the patient has asked for or demanded is required with those commitments, or with those requirements having been met, right, then it's not just a request, it becomes an entitlement, it becomes a right, right? And that right trumps any professional commitment or obligation on the part of the physician. And I'm going to come back to that in the very last thing that I talk about. Right? Autonomy is the central notion to the provider of services model. But what we want to say, and I think this is a helpful corrective to the autonomy model, is that while autonomy is important, right, it's very important to be self-governing, right? But self-governing is governing yourself in accordance with the rule. It's not just going wherever your desire happens to go, right? Autonomy is governing yourself in accordance with the rule, right? And we think that the rule is the rule of ethics. And we think that autonomy needs to be supplemented in order for it to function most appropriately by the complementary notion of authority. Right? So I'm just going to say a little bit about that, and then I'm going to conclude by talking about how all of this picture plays into what I think is one of the most important domains where we get conflicts of claims of right and claims of liberty in medicine, and that's the domain of physician conscience. So what's the story about autonomy that I want to give very quickly? Or authority, rather. It goes something like this. We should see that doctor-patient relationship in terms of two complementary spheres of authority. The physician has a kind of authority because the physician does, in fact, have expertise about what I've called the objective norm of health for individuals of a species. If somebody is a squirrel veterinarian, I don't know if such things exist, right? If such people exist, there's there are probably people who do see the squirrels, right? And those people know something, right? Those veterinarians know something. They understand the workings of the squirrel organism. They understand what it means for a squirrel to be healthy. They understand the various ways in which squirrels can be unhealthy. Many of us could recognize that, right? If, you know, the squirrels are really into nuts, right? And if you've got a squirrel and you like throw it a nut and the squirrel goes, right? There's something wrong with that squirrel, right? That squirrel is not well, okay? But a person who actually understands the species norm of health for the squirrel is going to be able to tell you what it is that's gone wrong with the squirrel's health and perhaps how it is that they can move to rectify that. Good physicians have that kind of expertise, and that gives them a kind of authority. It gives them authority to say, right, with some standing, some real standing, what it is that they can do for you with regard to your health, right? And it might be more than one thing, right? It gives them standing to be able to say, well, we could do this, but of course there's going to be this benefits and these burdens that are going to be associated with, or we can do this, and this offers some benefits, but it also offers some burdens, right? Or we could watch and wait, right? And there's some value to that because all of the things that I can offer you are going to come with some side effects, and watching and waiting isn't going to have those side effects at least. The physician has a kind of authority to be able to make an offer to a patient about what he or she can do in the domain of health for that patient. Okay? We think that's an important form of authority. But it's different from what we could call decision-making authority, and that's held by the patient. Right? The patient gets to decide which of those offers that the physician has the authority and the expertise to offer, which of those the patient is going to say yes to. And you might say, well, isn't that just autonomy all over again? I think it's not, right? Because it's the physician that gets to offer, and it's the patient that gets to accept. You can think about the autonomy picture throughout the last 60 or 70 or 80 years of medicine, right? As we first had physicians saying, here's what is good for the patients, and so the physician commands, right? The physician orders, and then the patient obeys, right? That's an older paternalistic model of medicine. And now things have swung, right, so that it's the patient who demands or commands or orders, and the physician obeys, right? The patient says, I want this. And the physician says, okay, if that's what you want, I can provide that. Okay? That's the autonomy model. That's not the authority model that we're presenting, right? Because the authority model of the patient being able to say yes or no to what the physician has offered has begun with the expertise of the physician with regard to the good of human health. Right? The patient does not have authority to order. The patient has authority to say yes or no. Right? And that no is very important. Right? And we can see, again, if we think about the story about my daughter, I have to remember that these are being recorded. I need to always keep in mind that my daughter might hear the story being told, but I don't think I've said anything incriminating on anybody's part. Right? The patient gets to say yes or no, and what should be the standard that the patient is bringing to bear on that yes or no decision? It's not untrammeled autonomy. It's not the satisfaction of patient preferences or desires. Right? The standard really should be the patient's vocation. Right? It's from the standpoint of the patient's vocation that he or she can say, yes, I see that what you're offering is genuinely valuable. There's something good here. But it doesn't right now, for me, fit into my vocation in a way that makes sense, or it does, for me, right here and now, fit into my vocation in a way that makes sense. If it does fit into your vocation in that way, it's probably something that you should accept. If it doesn't fit into your vocation in that way, then it's probably something that you should say no to, even if, in some cases, the consequences are very bad. Right? And the physician needs to respect that exercise of patient authority. It's not, again, patient autonomy, but it's patient authority. I think there's three valuable aspects of thinking about patient authority in this way. Right? One is that, and these really bring out, I think, the contrast between the way of medicine and the provider of services model. One is that everybody understands that authority is limited. Right? No person that we know on this earth, right, leaving aside larger questions, larger cosmological questions, no human being has unlimited authority. Right? We're all familiar with the idea that people can act outside the scope of their authority. And when they do that, whatever it is that they demand, whatever it is that they command, whatever it is that they ask for, is not asked for, commanded, ordered authoritatively. It does not need to be complied with. And so when a patient goes outside the scope of authority, right, that we've identified, this is true for the physician as well, right? What the patient is entitled to is not determined by what the patient autonomously asks for. Okay? To say, you must do X for me, when X is not one of the things that the physician has offered, is to go outside the domain of patient authority, outside the limits of patient authority, and hence is something for which the patient is not entitled as a matter of right. Right? Second, right, it's also the case that authority can be misused without it ceasing to be authoritative. Right? This is a different thing. Right? One form of going wrong with regard to authority is to go outside the scope of authority, right? Ultra vires, as lawyers would say. But another form of going wrong with regard to authority is to be operating within the scope of your authority, but making a mistake. Right? I, as a father, right, have attempted to exercise Hobbesian sovereignty over my children for at least 34 years, right? Sometimes successfully, right? Not always, okay? I'm pretty good at it. But I'll acknowledge the possibility that on occasion, right, even within the boundaries of my legitimate authority as a father, I have made mistakes. I'm willing to concede that possibility. But if I was acting within the bounds of my legitimate authority, right, then even those mistakes needed to be complied with. If I mistakenly told somebody, right, that they couldn't go to a particular party on a particular night because I thought that the people that they were going with were no good, and I was factually mistaken about that, that was a misuse of my authority, perhaps, but it was still not something that my children should have said, sorry, Dad, we're going to do this. And that's important because sometimes patients will make genuine mistakes. Right? Physicians will have very strong judgments about what it is that patients should say no to or should say yes to, and the patient, in some cases, mistakenly will go against the physician's recommendation. But they'll still authoritatively be going against it. Right? And it's wrong, as sometimes the older paternalistic model didn't recognize, for physicians to override patient authority. But here's the third thing. Right? Even though I think authority is real, right, and it has genuine consequences, right, needs to be complied with, it is also true that authority is very most often exercised well, perhaps best, in a collaborative fashion between those who have the authority and those who are under the authority. Right? It's very poorly exercised, it seems to me, historically and in my own practical life, for instance, as a father, right, if what the authority says is this is the way that we're going to do it and that's the end of it, damn it, right, let's go. It's much better exercised if it's done in collaboration with the people who are, as it were, stakeholders in the decision that's being made. Right? And so I might have very strong opinions about where we should go for vacation or what we should have for dinner on Super Bowl Sunday, on which America's team, the Patriots, will be playing and will win, but we don't need to go down to that. Might have very strong views, right? And maybe I have final authority within that domain. Right? But it makes sense for me to exercise it collaboratively by taking the pulse of the people who are stakeholders to that decision, seeing what they think, having a little bit of back and forth. And there is a sense among physicians, and this is something that really bothers my friend Farr, right, that the autonomy model allows physicians to kind of disengage, to say, look, here's all the facts. Now you do your autonomy thing, and I'm off the stage here. I have no responsibility for what you're doing. And our model is not like that. It might seem like it's like that, but it's not, in fact. Physicians should make every effort to communicate what they think would be a good decision. And if they think a patient is doing something that will not be good for them, right, then they should communicate that and exercise their powers of persuasion. Exercising powers of persuasion and engaging in communication is not a violation of patient authority. It is rather an effort to collaboratively engage in the decision-making that needs to be done, even while acknowledging that the final decision rests on the part of the patient. And so I think that if we adopt this authority model, right, incorporate it into the way of medicine, we get a much more nuanced picture of what that doctor-patient relationship is like, much better understanding of what the rights and liberties of both parties are like. I think that's beneficial for our understanding of medicine overall. Okay, the final point that I'm going to make for wrapping up, or in wrapping up, right, has to do with physician conscience. Okay. If we think about the neurologic issues, right, that really bother contemporary medicine, right, many of them intersect with claims of physician conscience, and increasingly in the literature of medical ethics, with explicit denials of the validity or worth of exercise or protection of physician conscience. And one of the things that I think is striking if you look at that literature, a theme that you see emerge through that literature, is that the notion of physician conscience is very frequently described as private conscience as opposed to professional obligation. Right? So on the one hand, as a part of the medical profession, you have a series of obligations that emerge from your being a part of this profession, licensed to do certain things that ordinary people are not allowed to do, with certain skills that ordinary people don't possess. Okay, with all of that comes a set of professional obligations to be a provider, right? To do what it is that patients have asked you to do, given that they've asked for it autonomously, and it's something that you can do, and it's something that's legal. And physician conscience in this literature is portrayed as something that's part of your private life that then is sort of intervening in, interceding in, right, intruding upon the realm of professional obligation that you have as a physician. Okay? And I think that the picture of the way of medicine that I've tried to describe this evening, right, really shows how false that is. Right? It's not false in every example. If somebody refuses, a physician refuses to treat a Muslim patient because of the patient's religion, or refuses to treat a black woman because of her skin color or her sex, right? Those do seem like private judgments that are intruding upon professional obligations. Right? But in all of the instances, right, that are the ones that I've described as centering around the really central questions of rights and liberties that are most controversial, I don't think that's what's happening at all, right? What's happening instead is that a physician's professional commitment to the good of health in his or her patients is exercising power over the physician's judgment as to whether some particular intervention is in fact in keeping with that commitment or not. And so when a physician refuses to engage in physician-assisted suicide or euthanasia, or refuses to engage in abortion, or refuses to sterilize an otherwise healthy male or female body, right? In all of these cases, it seems to me that the physician is doing it not as a matter of private conscience that's intruding upon some public set of obligations, but precisely as a matter of what that physician has decided is a need, a necessity of his or her professional obligation, his or her professional commitment to the central good of the way of medicine that we've been trying to describe. And so I think right here at this juncture, right, we come back to the importance of liberty and rights, right? They're not to be understood on the physician's part as a liberty or right to flout professional obligation, right? But rather, I think, and very precisely, they need to be understood as a right and hence a liberty, right, to fulfill the professional and the vocational commitments, right, that make medicine what it is and what ultimately we think it should be. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.